April 30th, 2004. We are back. This is the Tuesday night edition of the Linux Show, and I can now for the first time say that legitimately. It is the Tuesday night edition, because there is another edition of the Linux Show besides the Tuesday night edition. Finally, after all this time, yesterday, for those of you who haven't touched it yet, please don't go out and do this during this show. We're tight enough as, on bandwidth as it is, and after all, you got to listen to this show first anyways, but do check out our new show at thelinuxdaily.com. And our inaugural show was posted there last night, and we're going to be doing that show every Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, starting with this week. So, Yahoo, we've got our daily show launched, and here we go. Let's see what happens with the new Linux Daily. Those of you who have listened to the show and know a little bit about what it's about, we're encouraging anybody who is interested to give us a contact at staff@geekcast.com. Because we're calling the Linux Daily the voice of the Linux and open source community, and we're doing so not to be arrogant or to make people think that we somehow have self-co-opted that role as the speakers for the Linux community. On the contrary, what we're trying to do is get across the point that we're opening up the Linux Daily as a platform for members of the Linux and open source community to voice their opinions. So if you're a pundit or not, if you think you have something valuable to contribute, please contact us at staff@geekcast.com, and we will discuss you participating as a guest on the Linux Daily, as a guest commentator or a guest editorialist, however you'd like to put it. But this is a Tuesday night show. We've got the whole panel here tonight. How are you doing tonight, Doc?
I'm doing good. We
happily just moved in now?
Yeah, we're moved in, and we finally got our swimming pool hooked up and programmed. Little did I know that the system, whatever it is, welcomes both internet and telephone connections. So it would have been possible, had I known this could be done, to get on Wi-Fi somewhere and issue instructions for the pool to have heated itself when I get home. And we never bothered with that. But anyway, it'll make the house more sellable, which is the whole idea. We built the house to sell it, so. And the next house we do is not going to have a pool, so I'm trying not to get too attached. But anyway, it is nice. It is nice here. We live in paradise, and so, you know, there it is.
Well, why the heck wouldn't you want a pool at your new house?
No room.
Oh, well, that explains.
It's a good reason. There just isn't enough room in the new house, the next house that we're building for a pool. So, we could possibly move some things around, but we're already in the approval stage, so. We're probably going to break ground on it in a few more months, so we'll probably just try to, you know, make sure that we sell this house, which is next door that we're in that right now, to somebody who's friendly and will let us come over and use their pool. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah,
we will have a hot tub at the new one.
There you go. That's really all you need.
Well, I say almost, but, you know, I really like being able to be in the hot tub. It's like after 3 days at this place, I'm spoiled, you know. I sit in the hot tub, you cook, you go next door, you just slide over into the pool because the hot tub is like in one little corner of the pool. It's pretty neat. It has what's called an infinity edge, meaning that the side with the view of the town is a waterfall, and so you're looking across the top of it, so you just don't see the edge of the pool. Very, very cool. It's and it sounds very expensive, which it probably is, which is why we have to sell it. So, for God's sakes, I write for a Linux publication. You don't own things like this. You know, it's the kind of thing you just kind of possess it for a little while and enjoy it, like living in a hotel, and then you sell it.
Well, I tell you, I swear by the California Cooperage Redwood hot tubs. I love those. Those old-fashioned, but still the best. I love Redwood hot tubs. Have one in my backyard right now.
Oh, really? Well, they certainly look good, and they have the right feel to them. You know, there's a whole nice wad of those. The last place I lived had one of those, but somebody had filled it with dirt because they were afraid their kid would drown in it, so they turned it into a big planter, which kind of sucked.
Plant a tree in it.
Yeah, they planted big bristly little things. It wasn't really very good, but it was a waste of a perfectly good hot tub.
Yeah, but and,
I don't know. I'd plant an olive tree for my martini.
There's a slow-mo martini for you.
There you go. Well, I mean, once it gets going, you got as many as you want.
So, how are you doing tonight, Arnie?
Doing fine. Actually, I'm having a little knee problem, so I'm in my bedroom on my hands free on my cell phone and doing my RC by Zoris. by Zoris, by Secure Shell, by Wi-Fi. So I'm using all the technologies.
In bed?
Yeah, I'm laying in bed.
Yeah, well, can't beat that. Now that's a lazy man's network connection.
There you go. I'm sitting here, my thumbs are warm, my hands are sweating because this Zoris is warm. I got the charger plugged in. So
hey, are you on spring break right now?
No, I'm. That was last week.
Last week. Okay. Well, on the other end of the country, at least I think you're on the other end of the country. Are you at home this week, Russ?
Yeah, I'm at home this time. Doc, if you were in a pool over here, even if you couldn't see the rim of it, you'd be heading for it because you'd be cold as hell. It's chilled out quite a bit here.
Sure.
So it goes up and down, but that's what spring is about in Washington, D.C. So, well, things here are boring as far as the weather goes.
Have the cherry trees got baby leaves on them yet?
Yeah, that's, you know, there's a lot of talk about that. Unfortunately, I haven't been down to the district to take a look, but that's a big thing for people who aren't aware, but that's a big part of Washington in the spring is the cherry trees, the cherry blossoms. There are some just astounding sights around here with all of the various cherry trees that just turn, you know, it's just beautiful, beautiful white and other light colors for just a couple of weeks in the spring, and it's really great stuff. And unfortunately, I've been too busy to get down to see any of them. So
yeah, well, hopefully you'll have a nice warm couple of weeks because I'm going to be in D.C. 3 weeks from now.
Uh-huh.
And maybe I'll actually catch it. I've been to D.C. in the springtime a number of times, but I've never caught the blossoming cherry tree season in D.C., so I'm keeping my fingers crossed this time.
I could have gone to D.C. last week. They had a school trip there, and I hear it was just beautiful.
Yeah, last week it was good, but it's a little cold this week here in the Midwest and the East. And how are you doing, Kevin? You're back from California today.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, although it's nice and cool now, just when I get back. I was in San Francisco, it was in the 50s, and I checked the weather, and it was 65 back here.
Yeah, we had killer weather last week. It was great here. And so you came home, and now it's cold again, so.
Yeah.
Oh, well. Can't win, can you?
Oh, no.
We'll be adding some more equipment to the Linux show over the course of the next 2 weeks. We want to give everybody a little update before we jump into segment number one. We got a server set up last week, a pretty powerful one, that's going to be for the use of our new virtual PBX system. So patience, everybody. Within luck, within the next couple of weeks, we're going to have that virtual PBX system up and online. We're going to have the members of the panel here test it out first before we open it up to the general public. But eventually, probably I'm guessing within 3 to 4 weeks, you're going to see a software application popping up on our website for download that will allow you to call into the Linux show and ask questions and participate. That doesn't mean we're going to answer the phone. It just means you can call in. So hang in there. I know a lot of you have, a lot of you listeners out there have wanted to participate for quite a number of years, and this is going to allow us to economically do it. We're going to cut, by the addition of this virtual PBX, we're going to cut about $1,000 to $1,200 a month worth of overhead out of producing this show. So that's going to really change things in our ability to let people call. If we had let people start calling us now, with the present infrastructure that we're using, our cost of running the show probably would have skyrocketed by several thousand dollars a month. It's pretty expensive to pay that long distance bill when you're using an 800 number system. So that portends to be good. Also, on the equipment front, we installed another circuit, so we should have a little bit more bandwidth available. Not this week, but starting next week, the circuit's still being tested, so we'll have that available up on the list of places where you can grab a stream. Speaking of streams, if there's anybody out there who doesn't have the cash to support us but would be interested in participating in some way as part of the Linux Show community, we encourage you to go to our website and figure out how to do a mirror site. If you've got any questions, just feel free to email us at staff@thelinuxshow.com, and we'll try and answer your questions about the mirror setup. We've also have come to find out that a number of Linux user groups out there have set up mirror sites for their own membership and have not told us that they have done so. They're keeping it a secret because they don't want you people out there who are the listeners to know of the existence of their mirror site, because it's for members of their Linux user group. We think that's just fine if that's what you want to do. Go right ahead. If you'd like a nice solid stream for you and your friends, go right ahead and set it up. But let's go ahead and jump right into segment number one. I do want to ask the panel to save the first story on the list of stories on the website for a little bit later in the segment, because I'm still putting a couple of notes together on it. Our headline tonight for the Linux Show is the RIAA, they lied, and is that a surprise to anyone? Let's hold that story back for a little while. And why don't I jump right over to you, Arnie, seeing as you're laying in bed. I don't want you to fall asleep. Why don't you jump in with any other story but that and give me a little bit more time to work on the RIAA story.
That one wasn't one of my links.
That's okay.
The top link I had is one from last week, and that is, and please, anybody else, please jump in on this one. Novell management tool going open source. If we didn't believe in Novell before they purchased SUSE, and if we didn't believe in Novell as an open source advocate after they purchased SUSE, this is a very good first step in getting Novell into the open source community's good favor, and that is they have announced that they are going to release Yask, yet another setup tool, which is the SUSE setup tool, as open source, and this was announced before last Tuesday, and I had it as a link for last week if we had a show, and I carried it over for this week. It's a pretty good idea, and typically Linux distributions, at least the commercial ones, have kept a few of their tools back as closed source so that they would have leverage, apparently, so that they would have leverage in the market, and opening up Yask is a good idea. Any comments?
I think it's a very good idea, frankly, because I think we saw when in the early days when Red Hat did some installation tools. They were actually later adopted by a number of other distributions, including like Mandrake originally and some of the others. And I think from a business standpoint, it helps develop a sense of comfort and mind share about a particular technology. And so I think it's good for them, frankly. I think from a development standpoint as well, obviously, you know, the open source methodology allows many eyes to look for problems, and installations are one of those areas that you need it once or twice and then you don't touch it again, unlike some of the things that you run every day. So I think it's good to have a lot of people with a lot of different hardware looking at code if there's an issue. I think that's goodness, and quite frankly, you know, when it comes down to it, I don't think that they're really making money off of keeping this particular piece of code closed. I think it'll service them a whole lot better just to have it open.
I wonder how much of a eclipsing of the technology there has been. Now, I used to run SUSE, and the only reason why I switched away from SUSE is because of my upgrade cycle. Wasn't in tune to theirs. As a geek hacker, I try to keep things up to snuff a little bit better than they were. And so I left SUSE about the time they were really coming on board with ES2. And so I really have no experience with that tool. Now, my experience with the first version, with ES1, even its later, especially in its later cycle, that it was a very, very good, very reliable tool and very easy to use. I was quite comfortable with it. But I was using the console version. Of course, if you install an operating system, you don't really need a graphical user interface because you're only going to do it like once, and then you don't need all that eye candy. But, you know, the new version of YAST is everybody likes the eye candy. So the new version of YAST is a GUI. Have anybody used the new one? I think my friend Zeke says it's pretty good, but I'm not sure. I haven't seen it. Anybody have any experience with that?
I actually touched it, but it's been quite a while since I played with it. So frankly, I don't remember it too well. But
I wonder how much this has releasing this in open source has to do with possibly these single bootable disk Linuxes like Morphix and Canopix and Dynabolic are really, really setting the trend for installation and hardware detection. And I wonder if maybe just open sourcing a installation tool might be just a pretty darn good idea right now. To see if we can see if one could get some of those tools incorporated.
Yeah, I think it makes perfect sense. I mean, I don't think I mentioned it on the air, but I had a situation where I was loading nuts. I can't remember which one it was. Oh, Damn Small Linux.
Well, that's a good one. I've seen that one.
And I tried it on a very odd little machine I have here. That's actually, it's a desktop machine that has a third-party PCMCIA slot in it and a wireless card stuffed into it, and this thing, you know, booting up, no configuration, found the slot, found the card, activated the thing with DHCP, etc. So it booted up and everything was just ready. And quite frankly, most of the installers for the more traditional Linux distributions have a little trouble with it. But Damn Small, which is a Nopix derivative, picked it right up, no problem. So I think the state of the art has gone to these bootable distributions, the ones that are no install.
Yeah, I think so too. Either CD based or dongle based. There's a number of them that are starting to come out with Linux actually installed on a pretty beefy dongle. Plug it into a USB port and boot off directly off the USB port. It's some very interesting cutting-edge technology.
Yeah, I think this is a good move for Novell, and you know, I'm hearing, you know, there's another story I have on a link. I'll just mention it briefly. Is Novell and HP have signed a deal for putting SUSE onto HP servers, and if this trend continues, HP could be finally coming into the Linux fold, which is
maybe.
Time. Yeah, Jeff, you're
or not.
Or not. Well, you know, that's another story on the link there. The
yeah.
Second big story I have this week is a really, really phenomenally good article on thestreet.com by Bill Snyder called "Linux Juggernaut Rolls On." And man, if you think that Linux business isn't good, you need to read this. This is, of course, looks at it from a stock price perspective, and he looks at basically the two of the big companies, Red Hat and Novell. And what's interesting here is let's see. I'm using my Zoris here, so forgive me if I have to scan through here. Okay, after rallying to a late start, late last week on the news, Red Hat rose $1.50 or 7.1% to a 52-week closing high on Monday, and while Novell gained 49 cents or 4.4% to 11.66. And he talks about what this means for business, and it's a really good read. One of the interesting things about it is he cites, let's see, I'm paging. My Wi-Fi is a little slow here.
Well, I think what's partially interesting on this is you look at not only the price of the stock, but you're looking at two companies with growing market capitalizations, Red Hat and Novell, both at over $4 billion. Who would have thought, by the way, that Red Hat would have caught up to Novell this quickly? But that's an aside.
He mentions that.
Right, you've got growing market capitalization within the Linux sector. That's not the case in the majority of IT right now. It's just not. So keep going, Arnie.
One of the things that he really hits hard on is the market capitalization, and specifically with the two companies. He also mentions IBM, by the way. But this is a two-page article. It's pretty good. Red Hat's 61,000 enterprise subscriptions represent only about 4% of total server shipments for the fourth quarter of 2004. And the growth in that area, I said, given the expected future growth in total server shipments, 13%, plus our thesis that eventually half of server shipments will be Linux, the competitors have tremendous opportunity to grow their existing businesses. You know, this is a quote by a guy named Dion Cornett of Decatur Jones. This is extremely positive. Rosy outlook for Linux in business here, and anybody who says Linux is a commercial needs to read this article.
Yeah, well, that's a pretty silly connotation in light of what has been going on in the market the last 6 months.
That's true. The third major article is an interview with Linus Torvalds at Information Week. It's pretty good read, and Torvalds. One of the things he, in fact, this is the title of the article, is Torvalds, Open Source Keeps People Honest. And he focused, it's a very good read. Read that one. So,
don't go away on that story yet. That story has been quoted a lot by other stories during the course of the last couple of days. And, it's been quoted a lot in reference to some of the stories that have been out there about Skull, in particular, the open nature. I don't want to misquote Linus of all people, but just the open nature of the community breeds openness in general, and it forces people to, you know, to be honest, to behave in honest ways. And I think it's an absolutely legitimate comment about not all of the Linux community, but I would say a lion's share.
My favorite quote on in the article is Linus, in respect to trust. Linus says, because if we're not shown to be trustworthy, someone else can always replace us. You don't have to be able to trust us.
Yep.
Even though we're trustworthy. That's a good quote.
It's a good evaluation of the way conditions exist within a peer regulated environment. It's just the way things work out. If somebody is not trusted by their peers, their code just never gets submitted to their project. And I think it's a real important statement about
I'm done. Okay. Another one, a good point of it is that with open source and Linux, you don't have to trust the people because the bottom line is that you do trust the process. It's the process which sets up the web of trust.
Okay.
Go ahead.
No. Is that okay?
Let's see. One other thing. ARM is releasing ARM, who's the embedded chipless, fabless CPU shop in England, is putting instruction sets in their latest version of their embedded processors for the 2.6 kernel, which is good. Intel would do that.
They will.
That's about it for this week.
Okay. Let's go on over to Doc. Doc, what have you got for us this week?
Well, actually, I've got something that has no links, but that's itself, I think, a story. In fact, I'm writing the story. Hopefully it'll go up on the Linux Journal site tomorrow. And that is tomorrow, the new liberal radio network that Al Franken will be on, and that's been all over the news, is going to go on the air. The interesting thing about this is have any of you heard about this?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Can you name the network?
No, I can't, but...
Air America.
Very good. You win the prize. Okay. If you look up Air America, I mean, you'll find that the website is owned by a paintball company. A paintball company. And also, if you look a little deeper, you'll find it used to be the name of the fake airline reportedly used by the CIA to smuggle drugs.
Right.
Well,
okay.
In the movie.
There you go. Okay, so that's the story on Air America. If these guys had bothered to look up on who is or anywhere, any of the many places where you can look up a name, and if they cared about the web at all, they would have discovered that Air America was a pretty bad idea for a name. And if you go to the website, if actually you do scroll down and find that, in fact, Air America has a website, and that the website used to be called Central Air, a joke on air conditioning, I suppose, and a kind of a goof on the fact that they're liberal and Central is Central or something like that, you'll find perhaps, I mean, among radio stations and radio networks, websites are almost notoriously lame. I mean, they're just terrible in general because it's not their medium. They don't know how to do it. These guys, this is even worse. I mean, it's without a doubt the lamest website ever put up by anybody who's going to go on the air debuting something brand new. There is no information whatsoever about it other than the fact that they go on the air on the 31st.
But is this done on purpose?
I don't know. They're on, it turns out, they're on four stations. They haven't even announced anything about it. There's some little bit of news that I found out from a disc jockey who works at KFOG in San Francisco. He's got a web blog. His name is Big Rick Stewart. He's an old pal. The Big Rick pointed to a minor story in some minor business newspapers that the the brokered Chinese station out of Berkeley called KVTO, which used to be KRE, and KRE is one of the oldest stations in the Bay Area. It is, in fact, the decrepit old studios of it were used as the set for Wolfman Jack on An American Graffiti. Okay, so that's KRE, then, and now that's KVTO. And apparently they pushed aside the Chinese programming so they can carry this thing around. It's a terrible signal. You can't get it very far. It's one of the little graveyard stations near the top end of the dial. In Los Angeles, they're on what used to be Radio Korea, and before that was a top 40 station 1,000 years ago, KBLA. I think they're on the air somewhere in sort of a mid-tier station in Chicago. I forget which one they're on, but I'm looking it up here. In any case, it's one on 950. It's not a big one. In New York, they're on a full-size station, more or less. It's not one anybody... that's one of the first-tier stations. It's WLIB. It just happened to be called WLIB as in liberal, but it actually stood for liberation or something like that. And but that's it. They're also supposedly on XM satellite radio. But to me, the interesting story about it is... It's a lameness of radio story. You know, we're on the radio now of a sort, right? Right now we have more listeners than they have because they're not in the air yet. But I mean, the Howard Dean campaign just happened, okay? And even though it failed as a campaign, if you go to the Howard Dean website, the Dean for America site, and you look at Blog for America, which is done in open source software. It's done on movable type, which isn't purely orthodox open source. You can see the source and you can use it and you know, do whatever you want with it. If you go to Blog for America, you'll find out that people are still there posting hundreds, I mean even thousands of posts a day. It's like Slashdot. It's as big as Slashdot in terms of the action that's going on there. And the Howard Dean campaign managed to raise, you know, what, $40, $50 million, something like that. These are liberals, guys. I mean, you should go after these people. You know, they may even want to advertise. Who knows? I mean, it was just like, it was laying right in front of them if they bothered to look at it. Supposedly it's going to be webcast, but I can't find any place it's going to be webcast. It's just an amazing thing to me that these guys are going on the air tomorrow, and there's just nothing at all on the web about what they're doing other than just lots of news stories in the standard media. Anyway, so that's my main thing. It's what I've been writing about half the day, just because I'm sort of astonished at the difference between the amount of coverage this is getting and what's actually going on. I mean, they are just on the lamest stations in two of the markets, and maybe three or four of the markets. The one, WLIB in New York, was carrying Jamaican music. Basically what they're doing is they're pushing off ethnic music. They're pushing off the ethnic stations. So probably there's going to be a net loss there in terms of cultural impact.
It's ironic because they were talking about it on one of the radio stations in Chicago that happens to be owned by the Disney company. So, you know...
Oh, so they're bumping off Radio Disney in Chicago?
No. No, they were talking about it today.
Yeah.
On a Disney radio station.
Okay.
A big one, WLSAM.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And the guy who is on the show is this semi-crazy person who is sort of a libertarian, and he was saying, his comment was, the irony is that if he wouldn't say anything at all, these people would, the radio network would probably die. If it wasn't for people like him that we're talking about, because the chances are there was more people listening to him talking about their radio network than will listen to the entire radio network during the entire
first month. Oh, absolutely. And they were on Marketplace. They're all over NPR. If you look up Al Franken and radio on Google, piles and piles of coverage, okay?
Yeah.
Endless stuff. Okay, the station they're on is WNTD, 950 AM in Chicago. Their transmitter is down near Gary, and they have six towers broadcasting straight up the lake. they barely get into Chicago. Okay, it's not there at night. I mean, their coverage is pretty minimal. This is out where you are. It's not going to be there. I'll bet you if you tune in, it's already dark there. Try tuning in 950 right now.
No, you couldn't, because as soon as it's sundown, the Clear Channel stations tune up to 100,000 watts.
No, they don't. They stay at 50,000. But that's,
yeah, right.
No, they don't. They do. They do. I know these things.
Still, they turn their signals way up at sundown, because at sundown they're licensed to go for literally two-thirds of the country.
Well, the old Clear Channel system was one where Chicago was most advantaged. WGN, WVBM, WMAQ, and WLS were the four Clear Channel stations in Chicago, and they covered the whole central country at night. In fact, they covered the whole country. I remember listening to them in Yosemite, listening to WLS, listening to Dick Biondi from WLS in Yosemite Valley in California in 1963, and I used to listen to him in New Jersey, but. The queers are gone because they've allowed, the FCC has allowed lots of other stations on those channels at night. And WLS is, they're all 50,000 watts still at day and night. And there are lots of stations from Mexico and elsewhere that blast them away in the far reaches. But the thing is that three of the four stations they're on do not even have websites. That's how lame they are. The station in Chicago was a Spanish station, and it's now going to be liberal instead of Spanish. In other words, the liberals are knocking off the ethnics in order to get on the air. It's kind of sad. And these aren't brokered stations, which means you actually pay to be on there. You buy a block of time and you pay to be on there. And they basically just run the transmitter.
How else would they do it? I mean, they'd have to, what are they going to do, buy it?
You'd think with all the PR, you know, they'd have a way, you know. I mean, there are so many stations out there where they could be on. I mean, lots of little stations here and there, but I don't know what they've been doing. Here's another interesting thing: they collected 60, according to two news reports I found, they collected $60 million in investment money, including a lot of it from Rob Glaser of Real Networks. I challenge you to find anything in Real Networks about this new service. In other words, it ought to be unreal, right? I mean, he's paying the money to be on the air, right? So wouldn't you find it unreal? You go to look it up on Real, and you'll find a few stories that are on some service that Real carries, you know, about the network, but nothing otherwise. I think NPR, disappointed NPR. I think NPR is served up by Real, but it's served on MP3.
I think that the simple truth here is, there's only one way that anything will succeed in a advertising-driven medium, and that is some form of successful content. You know, it's really that simple. And the problem being, for those entities that have purposely gone out of their way to call themselves liberal, and there have been a number of them that have tried that technique to counter-program against the conservative talk shows out there. And the simple thing is they've always put people on the air who just didn't have the talent to sustain a radio show. Doing a weekly radio show is hard enough. Doing a daily radio show is brutal. It is,
no, it really,
really,
is.
Really hard.
Yeah.
And, so I think 6 months from now it'll be interesting to see if Al Franken is still involved, or if he gets bored to death with the project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, you got to really want it. You know, you have to be born to it. And you know, ideally, what Al Franken should have done is just said, "Hey, I'm available." You know, syndicate himself. I mean,
yep,
just do it.
That's what he should have done.
Just do it. You know, show us your chops, dude. Show us you can do it. He probably can. He's a funny guy. He's got a great voice. You know, but to be able to wing it for 4 or 5 hours at a time.
Yep.
The big hero on this right now, by the way, is Howard Stern. Howard Stern is like on the side of the gods on what's on the feds coming down on. You know, there was a vote last 2 weeks ago in the House of like several hundred to 22 for something. I may be a little off on this, but I think it was called the Broadcast Decency Enforcement Act. In other words, the Free Speech Repression Act, and allowing the FCC to crank up to $500,000 the fines for saying something indecent, which is never defined on the radio. And of course, they're going after Howard Stern, who did shit. I mean, the guy's hardly done anything. I mean, he's the guy. I mean, he may have distasteful stuff on there. He has that all the time, but he's avoided the seven deadly words. You know, one of them got out one day, and Clear Channel decided they were going to yank him. Right. But you know what? Even if you don't like Stern, you've got to, if you want to stand up for free speech, you've got to stand up for the stuff you don't like. You know, and he is doing just, from what little I've heard of it, I can't get the San Diego station anymore, but I can sometimes get the LA station, which is a weak one. And the guy's just rocking. I mean, he's really laying it out there. He's going after Bush as a repressor of free speech with both barrels. It's really interesting stuff. It makes really good listening if you can get them wherever you are.
Yeah, it's hard to picture Howard Stern as a politically active person, but that is the direction.
He got Christine Todd Whitman elected in New Jersey. He got Torricelli elected in New Jersey. After they endorsed him, both of them swung. He swung the vote in both cases. He ran for governor on the Libertarian ticket in New York and dropped out of the race when it looked like he really did stand a chance of getting somewhere. He's not apolitical, and he has a fair amount of sway. It's a very interesting thing to watch right now. There's a guy named Jeff Jarvis, who has a site called Buzz Machine, where he's covering it almost every day. He used to write about half of what was in TV Guide for years. Really good guy, very funny guy. If you want to follow any of that stuff, his is a pretty interesting site to follow. It's buzzmachine.com. Anyway, so, you know, we're on the radio, and I'm following the story right now because I think there's an open source angle to it. I mean, if these guys were smelling the coffee that is, you know, the open source angle on what made Howard Dean succeed as far as he did, I mean, that was a failure of the candidate. That really wasn't a failure of the campaign. They have a built-in audience right there. I mean, they could leverage off that in all kinds of ways. But, nope, you know.
Well, call him up and offer your services as a consultant.
Yeah, that's too busy. I'd rather just give him shit as a journalist.
Well,
it's the American way.
Well, we're going to take a short 2 or 3 minute break here and come back with segment number 2 of the Linux Show. So, Kevin, put on a tune, and I'm going to regroup. We'll come back with segment number 2. Everybody hang in there. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Segment number two of the Linux Show for March 30th, 2004. We are not having a guest tonight. We were originally having a guest tonight, and I'm not going to tell you who it was, because who knows, she may end up being a guest on the Linux Show sometime in the future, but she got jitters and chickened out at the last minute, or not the last minute, but yesterday. So we're doing an extended news segment tonight. I just didn't have the time today to spend talking to potential guests to pick one. We had lots of news to cover anyway, so we just thought we'd go ahead and extend the news segment and catch up on last week. So, Doc, we left off with you. Have you got any other stories, or is that the only thing you're working on right at the moment?
Well, not the only thing I'm working on right now. I'm also doing a report on having been at PC Forum last week in Scottsdale, Arizona, which is my favorite conference. It's very expensive, and it's one I've been going to for many years, but for the first time I was I moderated a round table.
Let's get it out, Jeff. Come on. You can do it. Is it not true that you, like, founded half of the conference threads at that thing?
No. I certainly had something to do with a bunch of them. I mean, the topics are right up my alley in a lot of ways, but it was. Huh? Are we all still here?
Yeah, we're still here.
There's some kind of erratic sound.
Yeah.
But this one roundtable was about federated identity and social networks. The social networks are like Friendster and Orkut. There's some very funny things going on about those right now. Have any of you guys done Orkut yet? Have you looked at Orkut at Google? Orkut is this way that you have to be invited to participate, and then if you're a friend of a friend, there's this whole protocol that Rael Dornfest, who wrote Blossom and runs some of O'Reilly's conferences, and who's a very funny guy, parodied one night at the Emerging Tech Conference, O'Reilly's Emerging Tech Conference, at the bar by walking up to people and putting his face about 2 inches from the other person's face and saying, "You are my friend, yes or no?" That's the protocol. That's the protocol with these social networks. You invite people in that same crude way. Anyway, LinkedIn is another one. Anyway, some of those guys.
I get a lot of invitations to join LinkedIn.
LinkedIn is actually useful. I like LinkedIn, and I like Reid Hoffman, whose idea it was and who funds it and started it. He's the guy who's one of the guys involved in PayPal, and PayPal's a handy thing. And he's a good guy. And actually, LinkedIn has come in handy a few times. And Dave Siffrey at Technorati tells me that he's found LinkedIn to be very handy for recruiting. And they are hiring, by the way. They are a very cool Linux-based company that's got... And he was there. He had a bunch of stuff to say. I'm on their advisory board also. He gave a terrific presentation talking about what they're searching. They search the corner of the web that they call the live web, which is the part that sends out RSS notifications saying something just happened here. And that's a growing and interesting corner of the web that they search rather exclusively. And that's, anyway, it's pretty neat. If it's too new to be on Google, there's a good chance you'll find it on Technorati.
Yes, it's interesting because I was surprised when I heard that Dave had left Sputnik to pursue Digirati, but after getting into Digirati a little bit, it's really interesting technology.
It really is, and it's all. And the interesting thing is he's sitting there. It's still his hack. I mean, he's there, he's giving his talk, and between other things, he's sitting there like, you know, doing MySQL coding.
Yeah, I mean, tweaking the code, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's got other people working there, obviously, but I think the team is only about 8 people right now, and a lot of traffic, and it's all, you know, it's beta, it's on about its third infrastructure, but, you know, Linux, MySQL, and other LAMP components are what it is, and if you're into that kind of stuff and you're really good at it, you ought to go to the Technorati site and check it out. And because they are hiring right now. They're definitely in a hiring mode. They've gotten some funding, and they have a business plan. I mean, not just a business plan. They have stuff to sell. They will make money.
Knowledge is power.
It's not just knowledge is power. Data is money. The cool thing is, because of the way RSS works, they only search the sites that have sent out an RSS signal, but then they can archive it. I mean, what Google sells is just what's, you know, this sort of flat historyless real estate part of the web, you know, the part that's under construction has sites, right? But with RSS, you can actually archive what's happened there. It's all the weblogs, and all the weblogs are already pre-archivable because of the way their site structures are.
Because of RSS,
yes. Brilliant. So, in other words, he can actually give away more detail than Google gives away and sell more detail than Google sells.
Yep.
So, right there, you've got a business model.
Yep.
Any way you slice it. And so it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. So.
Now, speaking of social networks, and I have a personal policy against ever bringing up a story that's out on Slashdot, because everybody has probably already seen it, but seeing as you are talking about social networks, there is a link that came out this morning on Slashdot about FunHigh. Have you seen the social network FunHigh?
No.
Now, of all the social networks, this is, without question, the most brilliant scam that anybody has ever come up with in terms of one of these goofy social networks. When you join, you not only sign up, but you give them a credit card, and you have FunHigh bucks that you can spend, and your function on FunHigh is to lobby two people to get them to like you and to become your friends, right? Just like you were discussing a few moments ago. And what you're trying to do is get them to buy you gifts like virtual diamond rings and virtual wristwatches.
This is FunHigh.com.
Right.
It's funny. It's very funny.
And it may only cost a couple of cents to buy this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've got a couple million people using your network, a couple pennies at a time really does add up in a hurry. This is such a brilliant scam. I'm amazed that somebody else did not think of this before now. It's just so elegant in its simplicity at ripping people off. I got to give the founders of this website the kudos that they are due. And it's so utterly absurd, it sounds like it has to be an April Fool's joke, but it's legitimate.
Hmm.
It's amazing. So anything else, Doc?
No, that's enough for me.
Okay.
Carry on.
Russ, let's jump over to you.
All right. I got a few ones, not too big, but one is over at a site called GeekSpeak, which I don't recall I've ever been at before, but I saw it posted, I think, on Linux Today or one of the sites. And it's a little piece called Open Source Heroes, and quite frankly, for most of the people in our audience, this is probably nothing new. But I think it's a very important piece in terms of reminding people what open source community is about, because it starts off with the author Rick Nicholas saying, you know, he was at a LUG meeting and there was a lot of discussion about, you know, who are the heroes of the open source movement, and he goes through a little bit of his thinking about, you know, what really makes an open source hero. And kind of the bottom line here, it talks about people in the movement who are just there to share whatever they have to help other people be successful. And this was something that, frankly, was quite evident in the late 90s. If you went to any of the Linux shows in the late 90s, there was just that sort of tremendous spirit to it all. And now that we've got all the commercial entities and the corporations and the business plans and everything else, sometimes the basics get drowned out. And I found that this particular little article, and it's not a long article by any means, but it is just one of those things to help you remind yourself what this is about. And also, I think it's a decent piece to show to people who are new to Linux and open source, because it defines a little bit of value for the community that is there, and it's the type of stuff that doesn't get the press. You know, there's no news bulletins about this, but about doing something that just helps to improve the world, basically, one little step at a time. So I think it's a neat piece.
Well, yeah, I got to tell you, I came to the realization quite a long time ago, frankly, that we have to respect our own heroes, because the simple fact of the matter is that no one out there outside of the community really gives a damn who writes the code, and so the average person in the greater world, even the average person in the greater computer using world, really could give a damn about who writes the code, as long as it works. So observance to things like this is something that's important from a contextual observance for our own well-being as a community.
And also, you know, he even talks about not only people who are writing the code, but also people who just answer questions, help people out, help new people out, help do installations, all these sorts of things, the basic sorts of, love your neighbor type things.
Yeah, the guys who plan the LUG meetings every month, you know, those guys.
Right.
What a thankless job.
That's it. And, you know, I've been around a lot of LUGs over the years, and some of them are still here, and some of them have moved on, and there are other new ones in its place. But, yeah, it's a thankless job. There are lots of thankless jobs inside the open source world, and it's good to kind of remind ourselves that there's a reason for all of this. You know, there's more to it than the stock prices and the corporations and everything else. There's a real human element to it all.
Contributions like Donald Becker's network interface stuff to the kernel, just like astounding. He never got paid directly for that. I mean, he works for NASA, but
he's done a ton.
It's astounding. His contribution. That, you know, if you consider Linux without Donald Becker's contributions, there wouldn't be much networking available.
Yeah, his interest in all the Beowulf stuff, kind of prompted him to help the drivers along, the network drivers, and make them have good throughput, because he wanted to make clusters out of the dang things.
And Tulip driver is really good too.
and there's just so many things, you know, that people like him have done for the community. And like you said, you know, there was no direct paycheck for it. Maybe it was, you know, some of the time may have been while he was doing a project for his employer or whatever. But when it comes down to it, he gave a lot more than he took, and that's true with the way the community moves. You know, if we ever get that in the opposite perspective, where people are trying to take more than they're giving, by and large, then, you know, things are not going to be as happy.
Yep.
Next piece I have up here is a review over at Linux Planet called Mandrake is on the Move. And it's a review of Mandrake 10 community release. And for people who haven't heard, Mandrake's going to this new system whereby they are releasing the community version first, and then a couple months later or so, they intend to release the official version. The community version is free ISO downloads, et cetera, all the good stuff that we like in the community. The official version is the one that goes into a box, has some support, and the reason why they're doing this partially is because the when they do an initial release, as with most pieces of software out there, there are inevitably a few bugs that that didn't quite get caught during the final review process. So the community edition is actually a way to get the thing out there and get it used and get some bugs flushed out, and then they will go on to the CDs from there for people in stores and so forth. And it's an interesting model. I think it's got some interesting takes on that. So I think that'll be fun to watch. The other thing that I would mention too, I didn't see it in time to send in the links, but I got a note today that Mandrake has finally exited from the bankruptcy proceedings in France.
Yes, they have. In fact, I've got an email from Gail Duval saying hello to all the listeners at the Linux Show and expressing his greetings and personal thanks for the support that our listeners have given to Mandrake Soft over the years, and that they are very happy to announce that they have officially come back above the line. They're no longer in bankruptcy. They don't call it, you know, bankruptcy in France. It's some kind of protection, but it's very similar to bankruptcy, but they have a different legal term for it. But it's the equivalent of coming out of bankruptcy. That's very good news for the whole team over at Mandrake Soft. Boy, that's one thing that's not easy to do, is to get a company out of bankruptcy.
Yeah.
That's a nearly impossible task. Not very many companies survive that. So kudos to them for really nailing down and doing the hard work, because not only did they have to do it, you know, at the conclusion of the dot-com bust and during a recession, but to face the competitive nature that they have faced, it's really remarkable that they're still standing. And it's good because it's a good product.
Yeah, and that's the bottom line here. You know, we're talking more and more these days about how Linux is going into the desktop, and it's finally becoming the player in that area. And Mandrake has been focusing on the desktop for years when it wasn't popular. And they have a good product, a very good product. In fact, I think probably about 60 or 70% of the machines I have running here are running Mandrake. All of my daily use desktops are Mandrake-based. I've been using it since 5.3. And 10.0 just came out. I haven't used that one yet, but frankly, I'm anxious to do it. Also, 10.0 does feature the 2.6 kernel, so that'll be kind of interesting too.
And it's Mandrake Soft. It's one of the companies that I was referring to, one of the Linux distros that has available the dongle-based distro.
Mm.
So you can carry around not only your files but Linux with you on your keychain. Walk up to a computer, plug into a USB port, reboot the system, and be running Linux. And that's a pretty slick way of developing a product. I think that's very cool.
That is. That's very cool indeed. So the review's out there for people who want to take a look. Next one up, let's see, is... Switching modes here to business a little bit. There's a report there on VNUNet about Novell claiming that you can save 80% by going to Linux. And, you know, do I think that this is the absolute proper numeric equation for savings? Probably not. But it's good to see reports like this to counterbalance things like those wonderful reports that are coming out of Redmond about how Windows is cheaper than Linux, et cetera, et cetera. So, so this is good, good ammunition, good fodder.
Counter FUD.
Yes.
The only way Windows would be cheaper than Linux is if you download it off of a Where's site.
Yeah, but if you've got a boss that's been reading too many of the Microsoft missives recently passed this under their nose. It's a name that that they're guaranteed to know. So I think it's just cool to know it's out there and use it if you need it. And then the last piece that I have for tonight is over at Computer Business Review, and it has the wonderfully challenging title called Microsoft Preparing to Release Code to Open Source. It's like, ooh, what is this? You know, what wonderful thing has happened? And, of course, what it comes down to is that they are going to include some of their peripheral stuff in their shared source offering. So, in other words, this is not only pseudo-open source, it's pseudo-open source that probably very few people actually care about. But somehow they're still even managing in something that has the word computer in the title, you know, Computer Business Review, to manage to get people to report it as open source. Pretty amazing when it comes down to it. But it's more schlock.
Okay, that's your last story of the evening?
That's enough indigestion for one night, right?
Okay, before we get into the RIAA, Kevin, do you have any product releases or anything for us tonight?
Yeah, Fedora Core 2 Test 2 is off today.
Came off today?
Yep.
Okay, how soon does that mean I'm loading it?
Don't know.
Okay.
I have my copy here.
You have a copy ready to go?
About. Just have to burn the CDs.
Okay, well, burn the CDs and I'll start loading up on Thursday. Okay, anything else?
Nope, that's about it for now.
Okay, let's go ahead and jump on into the RIAA story. And everybody on the panel can feel free, just jump right in on this. This, of course, is a story that we have been talking about for years. And I've sort of been holding back on stating one label that I've been wanting to put on the RIAA. I've wanted to come out and say, and ask the question, really, is the RIAA SCOing America? And I've held back in saying that because, well, the truth of the matter is, what SCO is doing is a total 100% fabrication. They're accusing the Linux community of a behavior that has not happened. There have not been massive amounts of stolen code, as they have claimed. So it's really not a fair apples and apples comparison. The truth is that, yes, there are teenagers in America that are trading files illegally, and the world will now come to an end because of it. So it really is not a fair apples and apples comparison, because one is a non-existent behavior and the other one is a real legitimate issue. Okay, but it's just an issue. And the contention that has been waging for years has been based upon claims, supposed research that the RIAA has done that has provided our federal government with information as to the impact that file trading has had on American purchasing habits, and that how file sharing is not the same as a pair of teenagers trading cassette disc during study hall. That it is, because of the nature of the simplicity of the act, it stimulates teenagers and others into becoming thieves and robbers. Well, first of all, they're not thieves and robbers. Let's set aside that label right now. They are violating copyright. They are not stealing, they are violating copyright. I know that's a subtle argument, but let's put this in the proper perspective of what it really is. It's just a simple violation of copyright. Do I think it's totally fair that somebody's intellectual property might be getting taken away from them? No, I don't. But let's also look at this from the logic that history has showed us. Every single time a new technology has been adopted or developed, I should say, eventually it becomes embraced by the dominant intellectual property industry of the day, and it benefits that industry. Every single technology that has come down the pipe, that has been the case. Originally, records were produced at 77 revolutions per minute, really big, thick, heavy platters, and during the 50s, the 45 RPM record was developed. People started replacing their 78 RPM record libraries with 45 RPM records. Shortly thereafter, that was replaced by the 33 RPM RPM LP, long playing record. Again, people started replacing their libraries. So people who had originally bought versions in 78 RPM had bought them then in 45 RPM, and then at 33 RPM, and eventually, when that technology finally ran its course, and recording tape technology first hit the market, the industry, the recording industry screamed and hollered and wept profusely, saying how unfair it is that the public at large could produce their own recordings. And they screamed and hollered so much without evidence that they eventually talked our government into creating a special tax that put money into the coffers of the recording industry for every single blank tape that was ever sold. Glory be, 20 years after the fact, it was discovered that the creation of tape, the creation of cassette tape, actually stimulated the purchase of more music, not less music. The same thing has happened with the original existence of compact discs. When compact discs first hit the market, people who had previously purchased their music on 33 RPM records and then later on cassette tapes once again replaced their music libraries with compact discs. So a new technology benefited the recording industry. Now let's jump forward into today, because it's been quite a while really since the invention of the compact disc. The only real refinement in compact disc technology has been minimal, and that has been the ability of us to record our own compact discs. But that technology was always an inevitability. What is the difference today is the fact that we do have the internet, and we do have the ability to send files over the internet, and we have heard nothing for years out of the RIAA, but complaints about how unfair the existence of the internet is, because it provides people with an opportunity to trade digital copies at the highest possible quality level, and will absolutely, of course, impact the recording industry and perhaps put the recording industry out of business. And that has been the story we have been hearing out of the recording industry for years and years and years, to the point that they successfully lobbied in Washington, D.C. and got a tax put upon the Internet, the CARP regulations, that has literally put one-third of the webcasting industry out of business. And that's where we are today. The recording industry, time after time after time, has had their way, without evidence, just telling us industry-based lies. And today, we got evidence of the contrary. I want to point to you a URL on our website that will bring you to a story that is on the Washington Post, written by David McGuire, talking about a research paper. I will give you the URL. I'm sure somebody on the IRC has already dropped the URL of the research paper itself out there. If not, I will post it to our website immediately after the show. But there is a research paper done by Harvard, and this is an incredible document. First of all, I want to explain to you the metrics behind this piece of research that the RIAA is called Baseless and Foundless. These people at Harvard developed very specific metrics and developed a whole series of algorithms that would allow them to monitor the traffic, the file training traffic that would travel across a specific network and measure that over time. And so they would absolutely know exactly what files were being traded. And they measured this over a long period of time. The second half of 2002, a six-month cycle, where they cataloged data. Mind you, this was towards the end, but still during what was supposed to be a recessionary period, okay? And so even during a recession and cataloging 6 months' worth of data of file trading, they came up with exactly the opposite conclusions that we have been told by the recording industry, that it is nonsense that cross-trading has eliminated the purchase of music, but on the contrary, it has, in the long run, been an ideal promotion medium for the recording industry, and that they have had a specific gain in revenue because of the kids out there trading their files. I think it's time that, in light of this particular group of research that's going out there, that people start acting a little bit more aggressively in terms of what they should be responding to the government about this particular issue. I want to call your attention to a couple of other key bits of evidence that I've dug up during the course of the day. In response to this piece of research, the people at the RIAA have decided that they were going to send out some attack dogs and contradict the claims. And in particular, one of the claims that is being made today in response to both this research and the fact that the RIAA sent out another 532 lawsuits on file swappers during the last week. A large population of those file swappers happened to be at Berkeley. And Berkeley was pointed at by the RIAA as one of the culprits, because there's a large percentage of the population of the students at Berkeley that are still sharing songs. The representative of the RIAA, Carrie Sherman, said has been saying over the course of the last several days that upwards of one-third of the revenue of the recording industry has been stolen by cross-swappers. That is a ridiculous assertion to begin with, one that they cannot possibly document. The fact of the matter is that there's the industry is starting to recover and is starting to grow again. Why is that happening? Well, it's easy enough to figure out. We're no longer in a recession. In addition to his ridiculous assertions of one-third of the record sales have been stolen, Sherman has laid the claim that it is obvious to anybody but with a cursory evaluation that recording industry is being damaged, because all you need to do is go to the record stores, the CD stores, that are adjacent to college campuses around the United States and you will find that their record sales, their CD sales, are radically down. Well, I contacted a couple today, and that is not the case. In fact, it's the opposite. Since we've come out of the recession, the CD stores adjacent to college campuses are doing okay. In fact, the record store that services Berkeley campus specifically has been quoted in the press today counteracting these assertions by Sherman. The owner and general manager of the record store has said in public during the course of yesterday and today that their sales are quite fine since the recession has turned around. So it's time that we find a different tactic to this situation. I don't know what it is. We've got to contact the government somehow. But up to this point, the RIAA has had their way. They've had their way with the government. They're having their way in the courts. And this has got to stop. Don't know what to say about the process of how to stop it, but enough is enough. We now have the evidence, at least, to wave in the face of the government to saying that all is not as the RIAA claims. Now, I want to throw out one more frightening series of numbers. And Doc, I don't know if you're still online. I know you love numbers. But so far, of all of the cases in the United States alone, of all of the cases that they have filed, 400 have been settled. And of the 400 that have been settled, the average has been for $3,000. Okay? Now, mind you, one of those settled cases was with a 13-year-old girl, had to pay $3,000 to buy her way out of recording jail. This is something we have to do something now to stop this. This is getting to be absurd. I think that the RIAA has indeed gotten away with scoing America. Anybody else like to comment on this story?
Well, I haven't read the entire thing. I read some of it. I would like to see the research and see what kind of detailed techniques they use to find this. I'm sure there's some criticism about it, you know, it being not representative. But regardless, I think that this is something that we knew in our heart of hearts from the very, very beginning, that people who trade music do it because they like it. And I think that is the bottom line. Anytime I've shared music with other people, it's because it's an album I like. And I want to share that enjoyment with somebody else. So I'll end up an album or something, you know. And I've borrowed albums from other people and played them on my equipment, and I liked them, and I said, oh, that's a great album. Give it back to them or whatever. And then I'll go out and buy the album myself. And the concept of sharing an album with somebody by lending it to them is no different than downloading it off the Internet. I mean, the album is usually always better, especially with the way people cut their encode their albums. So I think this is right on target, Jeff.
Yep. No, I think that, and this is not the first research study that has contradicted the RIAA. It is not. But I think the metrics of the way this research was done is so solid. At least I've gone through the report a couple of times, and that's why the quality of the metrics is what made me want to put this as our headline tonight, is because this is really something that was done by some very, very serious people who really understand, people who get the technology. and know what it's capable of, and the things that they tracked. Keep in mind, what they did is they tracked the popularity of individual tracks, and then compared the popularity of, you know, the numbers of those tracks that were cross-traded, and then compared those with the typical sales of that particular artist prior to and post file sharing. And there is no real solid evidence to support the claims of the RIAA. The plain and simple fact, the phenomenon of the lack of record buying over the course of the period from 2000 to 2003 can be attributed to one simple thing, a recession. And because the percentage of record sales is identical to the drop in the economy. I mean, you look at it, it is identical in the overall curve of the reduction in number of people going to movie theaters. It is identical to the curve of number of people who are no longer buying magazines. It is that part of the budget that people spend on entertainment is down, or was down during that time period. It's not down anymore. It's up. And so they can't make that claim anymore. So I think it's time that we call this what it is and look into the situation deeper. And because, you see, I don't think it's got anything, well, I shouldn't say it doesn't have anything to do with file sharing. I think this has fundamentally different goals than what it appears to on the surface. The recording industry has always been interested in one thing, and that is control and the enhancement of profit at any conceivable cost. They have done so with recording tape. They have done so with videotape.
They did it with sheet music in 1900.
Right, they did it with sheet music. They have done this over and over and over again. They have fooled our government with this big lie. And, eventually somebody's got to call them on this big lie. And it's got to stop. It just has to stop. There is a happy medium somewhere between free promotion and the profits of their corporations. It is an absurdity. It is just an absurdity to think that the RIAA is going to eventually get a cut off of every single recordable CD, the CD blanks, regardless of whether that CD is used to burn music or data. They're going to get a cut off of the sales of those CDs, and that's what they're lobbying for right now. This is a control thing. This is not just about downloading files. This is the same exact game that they have been playing for 75, 80 years. And I think we need to call them on it. Any other comments?
You know, it's really sad about all this because, you know, the hard thing is trying to separate the fact from the fiction. And yeah, they're trying to protect the rights of the artists, et cetera, supposedly. But, you know, when it comes down to it, you know, so much of the verbiage that's coming out is just so inaccurate. And like you said, it's some of it just looks fabricated, that it's difficult to have any sympathy for whatever legal position they might have in all of this. It's revolting. I mean, it's like I was looking. I came across one of the sites from the, you know, DVD Copy Association, whatever the heck their name is, and I was looking at some stuff, and they were talking about DECSS, and they make the statement there that DECSS was written for Windows. It was not written for Linux, and that's the first time I've ever heard that claim, number one. And number two, it's obvious that it's being used on Linux. I frankly don't know a single Windows person who's ever had a need for it. But they try to use this as their way of saying, listen, it's done for piracy, blah, 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 blah. Well, you know, guess what, guys? It ain't true. And you know it, too. There's just a lot of that stuff out there. And unfortunately, to a certain extent, lying is not a crime. Now, you know, they're using the courts, the court actions and stuff like this to hammer people and to make these lawsuits and everything else. Apparently the courts are siding with them, or at least enough that that the charges are standing long enough for them to come to these settlements. It's just not a good time. There's nothing here that's constructive or helpful for anything. And yeah, so much of this stuff is just seems to be whim and fabrication. It's very sad.
Well, the thing that I find is totally shocking on this, and again, everybody feel free to jump on in on this, is think for a moment of the fact that they have now settled 400 cases for $3,000. The fines that they are capable of levying based upon the licenses that are attributed, remember, there's a shrink wrap wrapped around a CD, and so it contains a shrink wrap license, but the penalties for pirating music can range anywhere from like $750 to it's well over $100,000. I don't remember what the exact fine is. It's $125,000 or $150,000 per download. Okay? So, you're a casual music downloader and you get caught, right? And you've downloaded a couple of hundred miscellaneous files, and they come at you and they say, okay, that couple hundred files, that's worth a couple $1 million. You can go to court or settle with us for $3,000 because this is the precedent that they've set. Okay? Now, your average human, how many CDs do you think they buy in a 5-year span?
Bunch.
Do they? Nah, your average kid.
Yeah.
Maybe you'll buy a couple hundred in a 5-year period. How many have you bought?
Last 5 years?
Yeah. What, 10?
Well, it's actually, yeah, probably about 15, something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, 10 to 15. Okay, what this is legislating, or I should say it's having the courts legislate a per household price of what the recording industry thinks that the average household owes them. And right now they're going after the quote unquote really evil people, but just wait for it to be expanded into other areas if this is not stopped soon. I find this really frightening.
Well, I don't want to go too far afield here, but I've had to make some observations over the last few years that somehow the legal system in America has gotten to the point where it excels at making mountains out of molehills.
Yep.
There was that, I, for the record, I've never been a marijuana user and all this other sort of stuff, but I have seen such idiocy put out on the American public about what's going on when it comes to marijuana and law, that I'm appalled by it all. I mean, good golly, the raids that happened about a year ago, where people were jailed for selling water pipes, as if there was one puff less of marijuana that was consumed as a result of all these big raids. I unfortunately I've seen a number of kids too that, yeah, they're doing stuff they shouldn't be doing, but they've basically had their lives ruined over it, and because of the way the legal system handles it, that it just, it astounds me. It really astounds me. There's got to be a sense of making the punishment fit the crime, whatever it is. And it seems like we're losing that sense. We're threatening to put 13-year-olds in jail for downloading music. You know,
file swapping. Yeah.
You know, come on. You know, when it comes down to it, the file swapping thing too. I mean, in our day, it was recording things off the radio.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I had at one time, and I'll admit this, I had at one time this case, and this case probably held 150 or more cassette tapes, because I would spend literally every Friday or Saturday, depending upon what day of the week they played it, recording this show called the King Biscuit Flower Hour.
Yes, indeedy.
And the King Biscuit Flower Hour, they would play a complete album over the course of either a Friday night or a Saturday night, depending upon when they played it.
Mm.
And I recorded those things religiously when I was, you know, 13, 14, 15 years old, because I didn't have the money to go out and buy, you know, okay, LPs back then were $350. But I didn't have $350. When I was a young teenager. But what happened? As soon as I got a job, I went and replaced all those cassettes with high-quality LPs, and when CDs came out, I went out and bought CDs of all those. I have put more damn money into the pocket of the recording industry, and it pisses me off that they're putting children, or they're threatening to put children in jail for swapping files. It just infuriates me.
Yeah. We need a reality check, is what it comes down to. We need a serious, serious reality check.
I couldn't put it any better way than that. Anybody else want to throw a comment in here, or should we just wrap it up right there, because we're already at 40 after the hour? Okay, it looks like no one else has got something to say, so we'll put an end to that. So, well, that's it. Everybody, make sure you check us out. Continue to check us out, not only every Tuesday night for the two-hour, or it seems to be approaching a two-hour show, or hour-and-a-half-long show of the Linux Show on Tuesday nights, and also start checking out the Linux Daily. It will improve over the course of the next week or two. We're still working the bugs out, so be generous. Don't be too critical. We're still dealing with new technology and new equipment and new software, and I understand the shows are going to be a little rough for the next week or so. So bear with us and check us out every day at the Linux Daily every Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. But until then, catch us next Tuesday night at the same time. For the entire crew here at the Linux Show, we'll see you all next week. We're out of here.